Hello, everyone. Welcome to Better Health While Aging, a podcast that gives you strategies and information about improving the health and well-being of older adults. We discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60, the best ways to prevent and manage those problems, and we also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory, or even the quality of an older person's healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Leslie Kernison. I'm a practicing geriatrician, so that means I'm a medical doctor, specialized in geriatrics, which is the art and science of modifying healthcare so that it works better for older people and for their families. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about sex in later life. My guest is Dr. Nicole Didick. She is a board-certified geriatrician based in Ontario, Canada, who has a special interest in educating older adults and families. She has been in practice for almost 20 years, and then after completing a master's in education in 2018, she started an educational website and YouTube channel called The Wrinkle. We met last year through the Helping Older Parents membership that we have launched here at Better Health While Aging, and since we share a common desire to help families by providing practical information online about aging health, Dr. Didick has been contributing to Better Health While Aging by helping me answer comments and by starting to share some of her own high-quality educational resources. She is also one of our experts in the Helping Older Parents membership. And it's been really wonderful for me personally to be able to collaborate with a like-minded geriatrician, in part because she has covered some topics on her site and YouTube channel that I haven't yet had an opportunity to cover on Better Health While Aging. So I'm delighted to have her with us today to talk about a very important such topic, which is sex in later life. This is a topic that Dr. Didick covered last year on The Wrinkle through a series of interviews with Natalie Wilton, a Canadian social worker and sex therapist who has a special interest in older adults and in family caregivers. And of course, this is something that comes up in practice for us as geriatricians. Dr. Didick, I'm sure, will share some examples of when it's come up for her. It has come up for me at times as well. And I'm sure it's something that has come up for many of you, our listeners, and our community. So I learned so much from listening to Dr. Didick's interviews with Natalie Wilton, because this is really an important topic that generally doesn't get enough attention, not only from health providers, but also, I think, from older adults. It's something that is often poorly understood by doctors and nurses and may even be misunderstood by older adults themselves and their families. So we are, of course, going to link to the series of interviews that Dr. Didick did with Natalie Wilton in the show notes, but I'm also just delighted that Dr. Didick could join me here today on the podcast to talk with me about some of these common questions that come up about sex in later life and key things that we should all know. So, Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here too.
Oh, it's so exciting to finally have you on the podcast after having you as part of the membership and also a contributor to Better Health While Aging for the past few months. So before we get into the topic at hand, why don't we have you start by telling us just a little bit more about you and what you do as a geriatrician in Canada, because what geriatricians do there is often slightly different than what they do in the United States.
It can be a little different, yeah. So I'm a geriatrician, so like you said about yourself, so I'm a medical doctor, and I have certification in internal medicine and geriatric medicine. And in Canada, it's a very consultative type of practice. So I'm not like a primary care provider, but I do see some people repeatedly, you know, several times. I see a lot of older adults who are living with cognitive changes. So I do, you know, a large part of my practice is people who are living with Alzheimer's and similar types of neurological conditions. And then just the medical challenges that older people run into. So a lot of it is reviewing medications, trying to stop medications that people are on if they no longer need them, looking at mobility. Chronic pain is another thing that we see a lot of. And every once in a while, sex does come up. So, but it's usually in the context of one of those other issues.
If I understand right, in Canada, geriatricians are really, you know, specialists. And I guess the primary providers or others will refer a patient or family to a geriatrician when they want sort of some of that extra expertise.
That's right. Yeah. And so we do, we have to have a referral from another physician or nurse practitioner who's doing primary care or another type of practice. But we have the opportunity to go into a lot of different settings. So for example, my practice, I do consultations in hospital for people who are admitted to hospital. I go to the rehab center that we have here. I even do home visits. And I have a busy clinic where people come in to see me. So, and I like that. I mean, I like to be able to see people all across the continuum of where they are.
Yeah, it sounds like a great mix. Well, I think it's so interesting to hear about geriatrics in Canada, because as you know, in the United States, geriatricians have, you know, historically often worked as primary care providers. But I think that's, first of all, something that I have stopped doing. I only do consultative care. But there is this question of whether we are all going to, you know, more of us as geriatricians are going to move towards that, because we're such a limited resource that there's a good argument for saying that we should really be, you know, coaching and supporting other providers, helping to build better systems. And then, of course, you and I believe we should also be coaching and supporting and educating older adults and families.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is the way that, you know, people do need education in all areas of their health. So aging is just one topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, tell us briefly about how you came to start your own site, and then how did you become interested in this particular topic of sex and late life, and how did you connect with Natalie Wilton?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it, because it is a project that I'm so passionate about. I just found after almost 20 years of doing the work that I was doing, I found myself seeing the same challenges. People were asking the same kind of questions and grappling with the same kinds of dilemmas. And so I found myself kind of honing an approach to give people advice. And I was constantly kind of updating my knowledge base and interacting with other professionals in the geriatric arena. So, you know, people like Natalie and that. And I just thought, there's got to be a better way than just doing these one-off encounters. Maybe I could kind of write down or do a video about some of the stuff that I'm dealing with every day. And that way we could reach a bigger audience. And so that's why The Wrinkle came about. And I watch a lot of YouTube. So I that was my chosen platform to kind of start with, was making YouTube videos. And the response was really good. And I think that people are wanting information, and they're wanting it in a way that's very practical and kind of entertaining. So that's where that came from. And then trying to cover topics that aren't really easy to get information about. So dementia is one, you know, talking about the aging brain, there's a lot of information, but there's also a lot of misinformation. So that's a topic that we cover. And then the sex, the idea about sex in later life. Well, Natalie Wilton is a sex therapist, but I got to know her as a social worker, because her other role is actually in working with people who are living with dementia and their families as a behavior therapist. So we're really lucky in our area that we have a program. If there's an older adult who has dementia, who has what we're calling responsive behaviors, then Natalie will go in as a therapist and try to work with the family and the older adult to come up with a solution so that we don't have to use medication, or we don't have to use as much medication. And so I got to work with Natalie in that respect, trying to help people with behavior. And then I talked to her a little bit more about her other hat, which is as a sex therapist. And I just knew that that had to be a topic for a podcast. And it turned out to be a topic for three podcasts, podcasts and videos. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've listened to them. So you have three interviews, audio interviews with Natalie Wilton that you've sort of turned into YouTube videos as well. And we'll definitely link to them for the audience. And I want to recommend them. And I'm excited to have you just share with us some of the highlights and key points for the three topics that you covered with her, which, if I remember right, you had one that was about sexuality and sexual health in older adults in later life. And I would love for you to talk more about that. And then I know you and Natalie also talked about sex and sexuality, specifically in the context of a caregiving relationship, when one spouse has really taken a caregiving role for the other spouse. And then when that caregiving relationship is related to dementia, because not all caregiving spouses are living with dementia, but many are, and dementia itself brings up some special challenges. So maybe let's start off with, you know, the broader topic, sexuality and older adults. So why is this such an important issue to bring up and for us to all get some education about?
Right. And I think, first of all, we kind of have to recognize, as geriatricians, we're not doing a great job of talking about it. So one thing that I read was that, you know, and this doesn't sound too bad, but 58% of geriatricians will occasionally ask about sex with their patients. And so the rest of them never ask about it. So, you know, we're not really bringing it up. And it is an important issue because it's a part of life. And we as geriatricians pride ourselves on being comprehensive. You know, we ask people all kinds of details about how they're doing in their day-to-day life. And if we neglect talking about the sexual aspect, we're ignoring a big part of somebody's health and somebody's identity. So I think it is important in comprehensive care. You can't leave the sexuality part out of it.
And if we're not doing it, I think regular providers are probably even less likely. Or yeah. What do we know about sort of people bringing this up with, you know, their general primary care providers, who are often mm-hmm. supposed to be there kind of tending to their health maintenance, their ongoing health and prevention? What do we know about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's probably, again, around that kind of 50%. So it doesn't really, unless it's part of a questionnaire or part of a comprehensive exam, which family doctors are doing less of now, at least in Canada. We used to sort of have the periodic checkup type of head-to-toe exam. Now it's much more focused and episodic. So if it's not brought up, then probably less than half are even talking about it. So in primary care or in specialized geriatric medicine, it's not coming up. Probably in psychiatry, it comes up a little bit more. And, you know, I think that that is because part of the comprehensive psychiatric exam is to take a very detailed history where, unfortunately, you know, usually there's questions about sexual abuse and sexual trauma, but that's often an opportunity to just talk about sexuality and that in general. So psychiatry does a little bit better. But in primary care and geriatric care, we need to do a better job. So that sexual literacy, I guess we could call it, isn't great for medical doctors. And then sometimes it's not so great in people, you know, the patients and families either.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, you know, partly it's not health providers are often not asking, even though, as you bring up, sexuality is an important aspect of people's life and well-being and health. I think also it seems that often people may not bring it up unless they're asked, because in general, in society, it's, you know, a topic that often people are less comfortable bringing up. And then my guess would be that also, I would guess that just when I think about family practice doctors or even general internists, you know, my guess is that they may even be less likely to bring it up as people get older than when they're younger, because I think when they're younger, we're more attentive to the possibility of sexually transmitted diseases. And that I think there is this very real question of ageism, right? That one of the things we sort of think, you know, happens less as you get older is less interest in sexuality, or just, you know, that's less of their lives or how we envision their lives. Can you speak a little bit about what you've learned about that, the role of ageism in this?
For sure. And that was one thing that Natalie brought up too. And she kind of brought to my attention, because it's so true. And I've probably even posted some things on Facebook, you know, that show an older couple, you know, maybe looking sort of horny. And we think that's so cute, you know, that we just think it's adorable that older people could be sexual beings. So that's one of the common stereotypes that is very ageist, is that it's cute. It's, you know, it's childlike and chaste for older adults to be in love. Or we stereotype older adults as being asexual. So, you know, as you say, that part of life is just kind of over and we don't need to ask about it because it's not an issue. But that's not accurate. And that's ageist as well. And then I'm sure you can think about the stereotypes of the dirty old man who's kind of lecherous, or the woman who's the cougar, who's, you know, an older woman on the prowl for a younger man. So all of those stereotypes are really prevalent in the culture and in advertising and in in the media, and they're ageist. They can be negative and they're just not realistic and they're not accurate. That's a lot of how people see sexuality in older people. But the truth is that, and you know, I find this as I get older too, like your brain doesn't really change that much. Your perspective doesn't really change that much as you get older. So just because you turn 65, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden now you're, you know, you're childlike and you're cute. You still have the same sexual needs and desires and the same needs for intimacy as well.
Well, so maybe you can speak a little bit more about that. And you mentioned the term sexual literacy earlier. I would love for you to say more about what that means, but also, you know, in terms of the ageism, I think also that it's often not just in the health providers and in the sort of people around the older person, but that a lot of people have may have internalized some of it, right? And so people may not bring something up, their sexual concerns, because they've internalized the idea that, you know, I shouldn't be caring about this at my age, or it's not appropriate or something like that, right? Because they're getting these, you know, we've created this climate where there are signals that that this should be less so. So I think there's, you know, a lot of misunderstandings among everyone. So can you speak a little bit more about sexual literacy and what you think everybody, providers and older adults themselves, should know about sexuality in late life, and also about how it may, you know, be affected by aging?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, it's so sexual literacy is really just knowing that sexuality is a normal part of life and that it's a part of your identity throughout your lifespan. And that's kind of, I get reminded of that every once in a while in the office. So, you know, I must say that I'm getting better at asking about a person's sexual health. But the way I used to always ask about it was when I took a sort of a sleep history, and I would say, you know, do you share a bed or what's going on? And then sometimes people would just sort of say, oh, we don't share a bed, or, oh, that's all over. You know, we're 80, or, you know, they would say things like that. Well, we're 85. We've been married for 70 years. Like, you know, I mean, that's kind of sad. And you're right. That speaks to that internalization that sex is just over for me. But it doesn't have to be. There are some age-related changes that are normal and that can affect sexual function. So if you look at women, you know, the menopause is a time when the estrogen production changes, and there are physical changes that are almost universal. So there's changes in the actual vaginal tissues. So they become thinner and drier. So that can definitely affect sexual function and can cause some discomfort, unfortunately, sometimes with intercourse. And then also it just physiologically can take longer for arousal to happen. So the arousal cycle might be up to 24 hours. So it might, you know, it might start before. It might be that, you know, somebody would be sort of ready to go in 20 minutes, but now it might take longer. It might take even hours. So those are normal changes, but they don't mean, you know, just because if a woman is getting that signal that, you know, intercourse is painful or something like that, it doesn't mean that a person should stop having sex. It just means that they might need to find a different way to do the same thing. And so I think that might be something that that people need to kind of understand, is that if it is painful or if it's different, it doesn't mean that you need to stop. It just means that you need to find a different way. So that might be something like, for a woman, it might be getting a lubricant, which is readily available. You know, that was one thing Natalie kind of was able to talk about, was, you know, they're available in drugstores. They're pretty much everywhere. So you don't have to go to a special place to get what you need. A doctor might even be able to prescribe one, or to, you know, to recommend one. So lubricant can be important, or sex toys. So that's another thing that a lot of people have maybe never thought of or didn't think were for them, but they really could be. And that's, again, just doing it in a different way is something that sometimes people need education about, and almost like permission to know that that can be normal and that it's not something to be ashamed of or be worried about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like what people should know is that the better approach is to remember that everyone has a sort of sexual dimension to their health and life, and has needs, you know, first of all, always for intimacy, and then often for some type of sexual stimulation, and that can change as people get older. And so, you know, it's normal to be still interested as you get older. It's certainly appropriate to ask for help and assistance in addressing it. And the aging body may create certain changes. You know, libido is something that is affected by, you know, the brain and one's emotional state, but also by hormones and things that are very physiologic that can change as we get older. And so even as those change, you know, the answer is not to sort of give up on that aspect of your life altogether. It's to be thoughtful about what kinds of adaptations could be made to help you still get, you know, the most out of that dimension of the human experience and of relationships.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you can still have sort of that sex life in your life. That's really important.
Yeah. Well, so what kinds of concerns have you had patients bring up in the clinic or have come up when you've asked? You mentioned one is that intercourse can become painful for women because of certain, you know, things that tend to change in the pelvic area with menopause and changes in hormones. What else have you had people bring up or has come up when you've explored this with patients?
Well, you know, one thing that I notice, and this is kind of borne out in the literature as well, is that for a lot of people who are older adults right now, so in this cohort, the sex is very much defined as the penis and vagina intercourse. You know, that it, when if I ask someone about sex and that's not what's happening, then the couple might say, well, that, you know, we don't have sex because that's not what's happening. And so that sometimes needs to be reframed. So a lot of the challenges that I hear about are around intercourse. So it could be for the woman, that painful, dry sensation and the changes in the tissues there. For men, a lot of it is around erectile dysfunction, which for males, yes, there is a higher incidence of erectile dysfunction as age advances. But it's kind of multimodal, you know, or multifactorial. So it's erectile dysfunction is kind of complex. It involves a lot of different aspects, but a lot of it is related to prostate disease and medications. So a lot of people will ask me about, you know, specifically about that, about the penis, you know, what to do if there's erectile dysfunction. And we can talk about medications for that. So it could be stopping medications that are getting in the way of erections or ejaculation, or it could be trying, you know, even in older adults, sometimes it is appropriate to try something like Viagra or something like that, or a mechanical device. So there are pumps and different things that can be used to kind of mechanically promote erections and help people to achieve erections. So a lot of the discussion is around that. So it's medical things that are getting in the way of intercourse. And then the other big issue, it's kind of funny because a lot of these issues happen in younger adults too, I'm sure, you know. And another big thing is mismatch. So the mismatch between the husband, you know, maybe has a different libido than his wife. And so the couple is experiencing a mismatch. And so that's very common throughout the age span, but it's probably more likely to happen in an older adult. And some of that is related to the health changes, right? So, and then maybe that gets into a little bit in the changing roles. So if somebody is having a health challenge and now maybe the wife has to do an additional job, so maybe the husband can't drive anymore and the wife has to drive now. So now she kind of feels like, well, I'm driving, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I don't feel like having sex anymore, you know, or I don't feel like doing the things that we used to do. So that mismatch can be for a multitude of reasons, and it needs to be addressed in a very individualized way.
Right.
But you have to, the first step is to talk, to acknowledge it and say that, yeah, you know what, that is a problem. You don't just have to live with that.
Right.
Let's work on it.
Right. Well, yeah. I want to hear more about your thoughts about how it can be worked on, but I, you know, would agree that I probably haven't asked about sexuality and sexual health often enough in, you know, with patients and families. Part of it is that I feel like often, you know, the patients that I see, and I imagine for you too, they have so many health and other issues going on, right? That, you know, that we're sort of starting with what seems most pressing, and it can be, you know, harder to get along to other things. But I do remember, you know, for several years, I had a primary care clinic at the Veterans Hospital in San Francisco for 4 years. And so that clinic was all men, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was
Yeah,
all
veterans.
male patients. They were all older, usually in their 80s, some in their late 70s, and many of them would come with their wives. And I have to say, it happened not infrequently, but probably, the most common kind of way that their sexual health came up would be that at the end of the visit, it was almost always at the end of the visit. You know how it is, right? Like, as you're
the
like
hand
wrapping
is on the
it up, exactly. They're like, oh, doctor. And they would say, actually, I was wondering, could I get some Viagra? And what was very interesting to me is that often the wife looked distinctly unexcited about this. And I even had once or twice the wife standing behind kind of shaking her head at me. So you can imagine the position this puts me in because the thought that I had was that, of course, a healthy sexual relationship is about more than the mechanics of whether the erection is there, that, there's more to it. Mm-hmm. And that clearly there was more going on there that needed to be addressed. And I felt like, well, even if I were to prescribe the pill, that doesn't sort of, so I guess actually, there was clearly a mismatch issue showing up right there. And I felt really not very equipped to address it. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about, first of all, not just what providers could do, but, for listeners, right? If actually it's seeming like part of the issue, when should they wonder, is the mismatch part of it versus other sort of physical or health things? And then what would you recommend to help address these kinds of mismatch issues? And again, as you pointed out, they show up much earlier in people. They say, like, just in general, right? For all of couplehood, the most common sources of conflict are sex and finances or something, right?
Yes.
So can you speak a little bit about that, the mismatch?
Sure. Well, and it's usually it's very closely tied to issues of health and maybe issues of finances as well. If we think about aging, and I've said oftentimes that age, getting older, a lot of it is, it's almost like going through puberty again. There's so many challenges. There are so many changes, physical changes, emotional changes, situational changes, right? So all of those changes will naturally affect your sexual health. And, other examples might be even things like a separation. So, and that could be involuntary. So if somebody needs more help and needs to move into a home or into a setting with more help, so, that could be a real mismatch in terms of a separation. But it could be something health related. So it could be something like pain. If somebody is living with chronic pain and just doesn't feel in the mood, or if somebody is recovering from an illness. So that's a very common thing too, that I think, we're kind of doing some research, Cancer Society and the Heart and Stroke Foundation, they do have some literature on returning to sex after going through a major health issue, if it's cardiac or cancer related, because that's a big thing is, people are worried about, is my heart healthy enough to do this? Like, what's going to happen? Maybe I should hold back. Or if your body has changed because of an operation, or you might have even had a body part that for you was really important part of your sexuality. Maybe that part is changed or is missing.
Right. Should add too that, I gave the example of men, asking for the Viagra and their wives seeming to hesitate, because the nature of the clinic was that all the patients were male. But of course, we also have, women who are expressing more interest or a higher libido, or the ones who seem to have more, quote unquote, demand on their partner than their partner may be comfortable with for a male partner. Or we also have, increasingly partners who are out. I know for lesbian and gay people that the older generation had a lot of pressure to remain in the closet. So I think as, the generations evolve, we'll see more same-sex couples or other permutations as we get older. But, right now, a lot of what we have in clinic, I would say it's most common to see heterosexual couples, but sometimes some of the others. So I want to again say, it's open for that. But it's sounding like you were saying mismatch is fairly common. And maybe part of what people should think about starting with is, maybe one possibility would be before bringing it up to the health provider, or maybe along with that, maybe you want to talk to the health provider first before approaching your partner, but it's that it is important to have that conversation with your partner to sort of understand what might be going on. and what they feel on board with or what they think they might need to sort of move forward or make the changes. Because I definitely got the impression that the husbands had either not asked their wives, you know, or clearly their wives weren't quite on board, right?
Yes. Yeah. Or they just assumed, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that's good for people to hear about, is that it's okay to, and again, we don't want to be ageist. So we want people to, you know, just because you've had this operation or that operation, or because you're 80, it's okay to want it. And it's okay to talk to your partner about it. And it's not okay if, you know, to just say, well, you know, I'm 80 and that's over. You know, it's okay to talk about it. And it's worth talking about. And the one thing that that I've heard about that mismatch is the three T's. So the one of them you mentioned is the talking, right? So you need more talking to each other about your needs, about what what you would like, and what you'd like to do, or just what the issue is. The other T is time. So it might take more time for one of the partners to feel like they're in the mood. So it might be that 24 hours ahead of time, you start planning ahead and you start thinking, you know, well, let's have a nice dinner, or let's watch a movie, or I'm going to vacuum, you know, whatever gets the person in the mood. That takes
gets the other person
time.
In the mood.
Yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
Vacuuming generally for women, vacuuming, doing the vacuuming themselves is unlikely to get them in the mood.
Well, it depends probably on the vacuum cleaner.
Okay.
But
okay.
Be
so
creative.
More so talking, more time.
More talking and I'm going to forget the other T. More touch. So more, you know, and sometimes, and I heard Natalie say too, sometimes taking sex off the table. So people get so fixated on that intercourse, right? And you know what? Forget about intercourse. Intercourse is not going to happen, right? We're going to focus on something else. So maybe that will be touch.
Right.
You know, maybe it'll be
romantic time.
Yeah. Maybe it'll
about,
be a massage.
You know, touch and yeah. connection.
Yeah. And just not, don't
in
take
a sexy
the pressure
way,
off.
But doesn't have yeah. to be intercourse right away.
Yeah. And so that can be kind of a real change in mindset for a couple, you know, if it's always been that this is what our sex life is about, and now we're going to take that out of there and we're going to focus on something else. So that is kind of, those would be the sort of the three approaches, I think, is the touch, the talk, and the time. And sometimes a sex therapist can help with that, you know, and because Natalie, you know, one of the things she says is that, and you've probably heard too, that the most important sex organ is the brain. Right. And so that, and what most sex therapists do is related to just talking. So getting to the root of the issue and then, you know, talking about it and coming up with strategies to try to move forward. And they can make recommendations, you know, they can make very practical recommendations, but a lot of it is that talking.
Right.
So,
because a moment ago you were saying, you know, that if you're, you know, you're 80, it's okay mm-hmm. if you're still interested. And I think, you know, the converse is, if you're 80, is it okay if you're feeling not interested, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's the feeling not interested because you've internalized these messages. You shouldn't be interested, right?
Yeah.
You know, or you're too old for this. But are there also people who just, you know, really either have never been that interested or are feeling less because they're tired, because their body and health have changed? In a moment, we're going to talk about sexuality when one of the partners has taken on a very hands-on caregiving role, right? But before going into that, you know, what would be your response if somebody came and said, well, my partner keeps wanting this, but, you know, I'm not so interested. Is that okay? What would you say there?
Well, you know, I think you're right. I think it's, we shouldn't expect people to have a massive change in their libido or their desire. And, you know, that's probably getting more into couples therapy, I guess, if suddenly the mismatch is just sort of coming out of the blue and why is this happening? If you sort of knew what you were signing up for and, you know, your relationship was one way and now it's changing. Of course, it's okay if somebody, says that they don't, you know, they don't have an interest, but it is, you know, it's important, you know, sexuality is a part of everyone's life. Like there are some people, yes, who are asexual, who really have no interest, but that's more likely to be kind of a lifelong pattern. And there's great things about sex. You know, it releases really good chemicals. So people having sexual contact and having an orgasm, I mean, it releases endocannabinoids, which is like the body's own cannabis, you know, so it, and it releases all those positive chemicals. So I would encourage people, if they're not interested, so maybe they need to explore solo sex a little bit more for a while, if they're, you know, because it is, it's good to have some kind of, I guess I would explore that a little bit more and say, okay, well, what is it? Is it that you want, you know, some time to yourself, or is it that you just don't want any kind of activity? And then I would probably, as a doctor, you know, I would probably screen for the depression or find out if this is a medication related issue or something else. So it is okay to not be interested, but I think it's, you know, as long as we've kind of explored why that is and made sure that there isn't some other way that we could bring a positive sexuality into it, then mm-hmm. then that's okay.
Right. And I think also, you know, you said some things that were important before, which is that there is this, people may, you know, again, getting to sexual literacy, people may start off with a quite narrow conception, you know, of sex, right? Like it means intercourse, or it means orgasm every time, or something like that. And that there is this more sort of, you know, expanded view where it's really about connecting with your body, you know, and then when other people are involved, connecting with that other person in an intimate way that involves some attraction, right?
Yeah.
And that, well, there is this more sort of like expanded version where, you know, it doesn't, you know, it is closely tied to romance, and that doesn't necessarily have to be intercourse. It can be, you know, like touch and other things, right? That once we present it as a more expanded thing, then, you know, there may actually be like more people who would be interested in that. It's just, yeah. You know,
it could just be talking, you know, it could just be sharing fantasies or talking about things, right?
But if it was this narrower conception that wasn't especially a good fit for where their body felt right now, you know, that was part of it. So I like that you brought up that it's probably worth, you know, exploring a little bit more to find that out. But now let's talk about sexuality in the context of caregiving. You know, caregiving for your partner, I guess we'll say, right? Spousal, although not everybody, you know, is actually married to the person that they're caring. I know this is something that Natalie has had a special interest in, and that you talked about with her. And that's of interest to me because, you know, so many older adults who are seeing geriatricians do often have a caregiver involved, and often it is the spouse if they have one. So tell us more about what you have observed and what you learned from Natalie about how that hands-on caregiving relationship can affect sex and sexuality in later life.
Yeah. So Natalie is actually doing a research project about this, and she's interviewing some caregivers, and we can call them caregivers or care partners, or, you know, caregivers is a term that most people are pretty comfortable with.
And as she long wants as people realize we're not talking about like the health providers, because sometimes people use caregivers to refer to people like you and me.
Yes.
I'm like,
yes.
No.
You're
not talking about sex with your doctor.
No.
Okay.
So your intimate partner.
We'll say your spousal caregiver for now, or your partner caregiver. Okay.
Yes. Very good. Yes. Important to get that. So she's really delving into this topic because it is often ignored, and being a caregiver changes the relationship, you know, and of course it's going to change a lot of aspects of the relationship, and sex is one of those. But again, I mean, care partners who have less sexual satisfaction, they report more depressive symptoms and more symptoms of stress. So the less sexually satisfied they are, the more stressed they are. So if you can be a caregiver who's having some kind of sexual release or satisfaction or enjoyment, your caregiving journey is going to be a little bit easier. And that's hard, you know, and it kind of goes back to all the what we hear about caregiving and self-care and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But sex can be an aspect of allowing the care partner to kind of feel better. Sex is really important for self-esteem as well, you know, so it's important, I think, for care partners to have sex, but it changes because
things are coming up. So what are the things that are getting in the way?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the one big thing is that you might be with your partner so much and doing those hands-on things. So this was one thing that I learned from Natalie is the types of touch. So a caregiver has to do more of that instrumental touch, right? So you have to touch someone for a purpose. You have to touch someone because you have to wipe some, wipe away some drool or something like that, or you have to help the person have a bath, or you have to help the person get dressed. You know, and so you don't, you feel like you're always touching them. You're not aching for that touch or to be touched, right? You kind of maybe want to be left alone.
You're taking care of them in a way that, you know, I think some people can find, you know, it's not
romantic.
Yeah. It's not feeling romantic to be in this very kind of like working role, taking care of them.
Yeah. Right. And then as opposed to that affectionate touch, right? So that's touching someone for the pleasure of it or to, you know, for the sensuality or to demonstrate affection. So caregivers, I think that's a big part of it is just the touch. And the being around the person, it's different. You're providing care in so many ways, right? So it might be that physical care. It might be that now that the partner's health has changed, the care partner is taking on a lot more administrative responsibility, you know? So if they're younger, it might even be with parenting or doing more shopping or, you know, running the household more because the other partner can't do that. So that kind of caregiving takes a toll. And then if we talk about the partner with dementia, it's the cognitive caregiving, right? Doing the cognitive care. So having to think about all the things that the other partner used to think about. So it's a big workload for a care partner. But if there can be some satisfying sexual activity, then I think it can make the caregiving more satisfying and more enjoyable and create some of that intimate connection back. So not just the therapeutic connection, there can be that intimate connection between the partner and the caregiver.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can talk more about sex and dementia in a moment, because I feel like that brings up, you know, a lot of specific issues for that. But just for the person who's just taken on a lot of this caregiving role, for a partner who is cognitively intact but needs, you know, a fair amount of help and has some health issues, what are some suggestions for people in that situation to help them get, you know, more of their sexuality back if they feel like they're having difficulty with it?
Yeah. So it might be reframing it, right? So saying, okay, our sex life used to involve these activities. What is it going to be now? Now that it's changed and our abilities have changed and our types of contact have changed, maybe it's going to be converting some of that instrumental touch into an affectionate touch. So maybe bathing and getting in the bathtub with the person, or maybe, you know, if you have to massage somebody because for a therapeutic reason, turning it into a more sensual massage, or, you know, doing something that's a bit more romantic, like maybe, you know, changing the setting a little bit or adding music or candles. So just bringing in, you know, getting a little bit creative in terms of ways to bring in that sensuality. Sometimes solo sex has to be a part of it. So, you know, it might be that the care partner needs to take control of things for themselves and find ways of what that's going to look like. So that might be introducing a toy or, you know, some other activity that it might be on a solo or it might be with the partner, but in a different way. So those are probably the things that, you know, that are likely to be adaptations that a caregiver can do. And the first step, I guess, is probably acknowledging that the person needs to take care of this part of their life, that, you know, it's not just another thing to sort of sacrifice and give up, that their sexual life is important and that, you know, they have the care partner role, but they're still going to be have their sexual needs met.
Well, as you know, I think one of the number one things we hear from people who are in a fairly intensive caregiving role, right, where they're involved every day, which they often are, if it's their spouse, somebody they're living with, is that they're so tired, right? Because they have taken on all these additional responsibilities and there's often a certain amount of stress, right? And anxiety involved with that, the changes of the person's health, the uncertainty about, like, you know, how long it's going to go on or how they're going to adapt. So they're so, so tired. And we know that being fatigued often, you know, affects people's libido or interest. Any thoughts on how people can get around, you know, that feeling, you know, but I'm so tired? Because, you know, sometimes when we tell people to take care of themselves, they say, but I'm already so tired and busy, and that they're almost resentful that we're giving them, you know, quote unquote, another thing to do.
Yes.
Right? And to feel guilty about not doing is what they sometimes say. Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I that's very true. That's very true. And so, yeah, to say, don't forget to look after your sex. I mean, we don't want it to be like flossing, right? So we want it to be something that's enjoyable. And so maybe, you know, first of all, framing it correctly and saying this is an important part of your health. Caregivers who are sexually satisfied are better caregivers and they have less depressive symptoms. And the other thing is that you might have to schedule this. So you might have to, you know, book off a little bit of time when you're going to have some time alone, have a bubble bath, and have some time with your toy or with, you know, something else that you enjoy, or if it's a matter of the solo sex part of things. So, you know, though that can sound pretty practical and unromantic, but I think that, you know, once if those strategies are employed and if they are successful, then people, you know, might continue with it. So those would be, it sounds really odd, right? But, you know, sometimes I find in the office, like just giving people permission and saying that, you know, this is important for you. It's almost, some people it's helpful to have it framed in a selfless way. So to say, this is actually a selfless act because we need you to take care of this so that you can be more relaxed and be a better person. And, you know, it seems like one more thing to do, but it's something that's going to make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
At the end.
Yeah. Or reiterating that it's worth getting some respite or just, you know, some arranging for some time to yourself to attend to this and some other things that you should be doing for yourself, because that's what's going to enable you to support your partner better, longer, and because you deserve it just for yourself.
You do. And you might be preventing other health complications, right? Because if you don't sort of maintain your sexual equipment, you might run into problems. You know, so if it's kind of a use it or lose it, so it can be important to keep, you know, to keep yourself going in that area. Yeah, that's what I would try.
Yeah, those are great suggestions. And so again, you know, more talking, more time, more touch. The three T's.
That's right, the like three T's. Yeah, that's a good
one. Come back to those too. So now let's talk about sexuality when one person in the relationship has developed a dementia such as Alzheimer's disease or some other kind of chronic condition affecting their memory and thinking, right? So most often people like that are forgetful, but sometimes they may not be terribly forgetful, but, you know, in other ways, their, you know, thinking and brain function is not what it used to be. Let's start by having you just recap for us, like, what are particular issues that tend to come up when somebody has dementia, and how does that affect their sexuality and their sex life with their partner if they have one?
So, I mean, it's a big topic and it for sure overlaps with the care partner topic or caregiver topic, because dementia is a pretty big change in a relationship. And if we just think about most of the types of dementia, so even if we just think about the parts of the brain that can be affected, right? So if the temporal lobes of the brain are affected, that can lead to people just having less of a filter and sort of less inhibitions. So maybe, you know, before you would think that you want to pinch somebody's bottom, but you don't actually do it. So if your brain has changed, you might go ahead and act on that impulse.
Right. And that's true also with frontal lobes being affected.
Right.
And especially frontotemporal dementia. They lose a lot of inhibition and control.
A lot of inhibition.
Like the grown-up adult in the brain, right? So, or people might say things they used to just think, like, ooh, you're hot, I would take you to bed.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
You know, and then also in those frontal lobes, there can be just apathy and loss of interest. So those things can really change. And then memory, as you mentioned, right? So more of those parietal lobes and that. So people can forget the partner, right? That's kind of an extreme case, but, you know, might forget the partner, might forget who they are or their age or that they are married. So all of those changes will have consequences on behavior. So, you know, it's pretty hard to talk about dementia and sex without someone thinking about the problems, right? Or that it's a problematic behavior. So it's and there's even a term for it in geriatrics, right? It's ISB, it's inappropriate sexual behavior. So, you know, I think that sometimes it is, but it doesn't always have to be. So when I think about sex and dementia, I try to sort of start with an open mind and say that the sexual expression is a right that everybody has. You know, the World Health Organization has made a statement about that, that as long as sexual expression is respectful and consensual, that it's a right that everyone has to sexual expression. So keeping an open mind, it's important for people. It might even be more important when the person has changes in the brain. You know, because it does promote self-esteem. So somebody who is having sex, you know, can feel better about themselves. It can be that physical release as well. And it can just be kind of an enjoyable activity that the person, you know, can still get a lot out of. So we shouldn't just say that when there's dementia, sex is over. I think we have to be kind of, you know, we have to recognize that there can be a place in the changing brain landscape for people to have a normal and very positive sex life. Mm-hmm. But it is complicating.
Right. I mean, I think you're bringing up something, you know, quite important, which is that although some people are going to develop apathy and really lose interest in it, many people will maintain their usual interest and drives and needs. And that, you know, the issue is just that they may not be able to direct them or express them the way they could with their normally functioning brain. And so we should actually realize that often what we see expressed, which may be labeled as inappropriate, is just their normal drives and needs for intimacy, for connection with people, for, you know, manifesting attraction and wanting some romantic or sexual touch or activity, that it's just that normal drive being expressed in different ways because they, you know, can't filter their behaviors or languages appropriately, or because they may be forgetting. And you and I know that what's most common is for people to forget more recent things. You know, they tend to remember long ago things, so they may not remember a more recent, newer spouse or partner. They may be talking about the one they had before. They sometimes change how they're feeling about a particular partner, but are interested in something else, and that it's really just because their brain has changed in certain ways, they may still have that need to connect and to have that aspect of, you know, that human drive for also intimate physical touch. And then also, you know, in terms of people becoming forgetful, I think that also raises some issues for consent, right?
Yeah. So that's important. So, you know, and that's one thing Natalie and I talked about too, because that does come up and it can become a real family crisis at times, right? And I'm sure you've seen that too. It could be that the mismatch is really exaggerated, or it could be that the one partner is living in a different setting and has a new partner. And it, you know, it could be that the mother is living with dementia and there's a guy at the long-term care home that's, you know, they're kind of dating and that's very upsetting. So it's very complicated, but it's also something that I don't think there's a blanket answer. So we can't say, well, people who've been intimate partners for a long time, well, they consent, you know, because they're married. So they can, you know, it's okay always for them to have sex. Or to say that, well, because mom has dementia, she can't consent to that. So I think it's very much an individual thing. And it can often be, if one partner isn't living with dementia, it's often a moment by moment evaluation of whether or not it's okay to proceed or whether it's not. So it is very challenging, and it's definitely an issue. But just because someone's living with dementia, it doesn't mean they can't consent to sexual contact. It just means that it's something that needs to be managed pretty carefully. Yeah.
Well, in listening to your interview with Natalie, and this one I thought was very good, and I want to recommend it, especially for people, you know, listening who are living with somebody with dementia or have a family member, even if, you know, sexuality hasn't been an issue or concern, I think it's worth it because it was such a good example of thinking through behaviors in dementia, right? That often there are behaviors that other people are perceiving as bothersome or inappropriate. They may be perceived as sexual or not. And that when we take an approach of really thinking through and trying to understand what might be driving it, we can have so much more empathy and we can be more successful. And so she gave some examples that I thought were really interesting of people with dementia manifesting certain behaviors that other people assumed were sexual and inappropriate, you know, like walking in, you know, for somebody in a facility, in a residential home, you know, walking into someone else's room holding your penis. And in fact, the person, you know, that older man with dementia just had to go to the bathroom and couldn't find,
find the bathroom. Right. And
so I thought that was a good reminder for all of us that although sometimes a person with dementia may be trying to manifest a sexually related need for intimacy, for touch, for sexual release, sometimes they're not. We're just misinterpreting because they're having some confusion and we sort of slap on this label.
Yes.
That it's a sexually driven behavior when it might be something else. So
once that label's on there too, it can kind of follow the person, right? And it can almost mark somebody as a predator or inappropriate when they're really not. So yeah, that's very important.
Or if it is their sexuality, thinking, you know, what are appropriate ways we can address this need that they have, right?
Yep.
Because that need is there, it's important. And when we try to stuff it down, you know, that's often not serving the person.
Right, at all.
For their quality of life. Although I think you mentioned in the interview with her that sometimes, you know, we do end up turning to medications if we can't find an otherwise suitable way to address the person's needs, that then we might turn to one of those medications that tends to dampen libido to help with that. So maybe we can come back to, you know, again, like the care, you know, in the context of a partnership, right? A pre-existing partnership, how dementia can change that sexual relationship and what comes up for the caregiving partner. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the things that you and Natalie have seen come up and how people, you know, might think about them differently or what to know?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, a big one is the understanding, and I think you put it really well. So kind of understanding what's going on in the brain and seeing the behavior as a need. So every behavior is an unmet need, especially the sort of the behaviors that we think of as problematic or changed. So it's really important to know the whole person. So to even understand their cohort, right? And to understand who they were. Maybe they were the classic guy that I'll see is someone who was in sales, you know, and sort of would be like a madman type of character, right? So it was just part of that person's cohort to kind of be a me too kind of person, you know, and it was more socially acceptable for that person's cohort and for that time. And then now that the brain has changed, the person is kind of reverting to that kind of behavior. So it's really understanding who the person is, just kind of understand where the behavior is coming from. Sometimes for the partner, it's taking away some of that embarrassment and just sort of, you know, acknowledging that the change is a part of the brain change, and it's not necessarily, because sometimes that can even make the world smaller, you know, if the partner sort of perceives that there's a behavior that might be problematic if they take them out, you know, they might flirt or they might do things. So to kind of normalize it for the care partner and say, okay, but from his perspective, it's okay. And, we don't want you to feel embarrassed about that. I would say that's something that comes up a lot. And then sometimes it is that there's a renegotiation, and sometimes this can happen early on in a dementia journey. So a couple will, you know, sometimes renegotiate. Well, what will happen if I have to go and live somewhere else? Like, or, you know, I don't really remember that I'm married to you. Like, is it okay for you to have another relationship? Because sometimes care partners can be judged very harshly because they are, you know, entering into a new relationship. But maybe that's something that the couple has negotiated. And, you know, and that, so that's between them, because sometimes that's appropriate and that's acceptable. So, you know, I think that's something that I would probably say early on in a relationship is to maybe think about that and talk about it, so that can take a lot of the anguish out of it when there can be a new partner or a new relationship, because it does happen. It happens a lot.
Yeah. So kind of as part of the advanced planning, which ideally everyone diagnosed with dementia, ideally people would be diagnosed early enough to, you know, have some thoughtful time to think about the future, what lies ahead, talk about people they're close to, what it might look like. And that part of that should not just be, where would I want to live and, you know, how would I get care if when I need a lot more care, because the nature of dementia is that people eventually will need a lot more care. but that it would also be, as my brain changes, my health changes, that's going to change our relationship. What might we do if I forget you're my partner and express interests in other people, you know, if I'm in a facility and, you know, want to snuggle in bed with, you know, someone else I've met there. And, you know, what if you, my care partner who doesn't have dementia, you know, are feeling the need to have your, you know, your sexual life addressed?
Yeah.
You know,
it's good to talk.
Like,
about
could
it.
You, you know, look outside? Like, what would that look like? At what point would that be okay?
Mm-hmm. And it would take so much of the guilt out of it, you know, and it's really hard to talk about. And for people's children too, you know, it's just unthinkable, often for the kids, but there's so much guilt associated with it. And, you know, sometimes it's helpful. One thing Natalie said is to, you know, to try to get past that guilt is to maybe redirect the resentment to the disease, you know, and say, look, I wish that this dementia wasn't here. You know, it's caused these changes. It's getting in the way, you know, resent the disease, but allow the person to find intimacy and comfort in whatever way that they can, you know, but just to let go of that guilt. So if that can be just talked about before, you know, before it's too late, then that can alleviate.
More talking. More time.
More talking and more time.
More touch.
More touch.
They're still all three really good.
I didn't make that up, but I think it's a great.
No, but they're great. Okay.
But it's true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Nicole, this has been like so wonderful and informative. And again, I want to encourage everyone to also listen to your interviews for more on this. But, you know, in wrapping things up, maybe we can go just recap our key points. And then I would love for you to share where people interested in this topic might be able to learn more so that they can improve their sexual literacy, better understand themselves, better connect with their partner or people who are involved in their lives. Any favorite, well, let's start with our top recommendations. Then maybe you can share some favorite resources.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think the main thing is that I really want people to be sex positive. You know, I want people to kind of recognize that they're entitled to have a sex life, no matter how old they are, and that that's going to change like everything does in life and with aging, but that it's okay to talk about that and to advocate for that and to bust through some of those ageist myths and preconceptions. So that's really important. And there are some natural changes with physiology that have solutions to them or have ways around. And again, like most things with aging, it's going to be doing it, but doing it in a different way. And so that's what I would like people to do when it comes to sex, is that if you expect your sex life to be like it was when you were 30, it's not going to be, but it can still be, and it can be different, and maybe it could even be better. So don't just close that door, and do talk to your doctor and do ask for help. And you might have to think out of the box and push yourself out of your comfort zone to get that help, but it'll be worth it because you deserve it. Sounds like an ad.
Yeah,
but it's true, right?
But
you
it's
deserve
true.
To have a good sex life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You do.
And I think, again, what you said about like being open-minded, that that might look different than what you had in mind, right? But that there can be so much more to it than maybe what you were relying on before. And that, again, you know, the key is, you know, more talking, more time, more touch, and then, you know, learning more about what might be possible, what to consider, you know, what to ask yourself and what to ask your partner can all be really helpful. And then do you have any favorite resources online or elsewhere to recommend to the audience?
You know what? I didn't jot them down. I do. There's a few that, you know, Natalie has many more than I do. I will make sure to have them available as links on the page.
Yes, we can add them to the show notes.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think, and there's some other people that I think are great in this space that have other channels and that. And so I will be sure to link some of those.
Right. And then we're also working on having you write for us an article on better health while aging related to your work on this. So once we get that up on Better Health While Aging, we'll be sharing that. And then, of course, there is, you know, your own site and YouTube channel. I want to say that I really enjoy your videos. I think they're great. And I like it too, because video is not something that I particularly do, but I think it's important to have lots modalities to offer people. And then your interviews with Natalie Wilton in particular are a great resource. Well, thank you once again for coming to talk about this today, but also for connecting with me.
It's been so good.
It's been so fun to collaborate with you. And so thank you for covering this topic. Then I hope to just have you back for either more on this or another topic at some point.
Anytime. Just ask. Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, I love it. I'm so glad that we were able to collaborate and just keep, you know, keep getting that great information out there from trusted physicians, right? Trusted geriatricians.
That's right. We're here.
I think it's really
bring geriatrics to the world. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Really valuable.
And with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode of Better Health While Aging. If you have any questions about something you heard in this episode, you can post it on the show notes page for the episode. I'll also be posting some links to some of the resources that I mentioned in the episode. To find the show notes, visit betterhealthwhileaging.net and click podcast in the main menu at the top. Last but not least, if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to support us by subscribing on iTunes. And if you've already done that, please leave a rating and review. This makes it easier for others to discover our show in iTunes, and I would love for the many people who are interested in health or aging or family caregivers to be able to find it and give it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, and I'm looking forward to you joining us for future episodes.